Under the radar means hearing about things you didn't know you needed to know until you hear them.
It's a serious look.
Hear about the issues that don't get the attention they deserve.
Under the radar doesn't get caught up in the day-to-day.
Surfacing issues that are not talked about in mainstream media.
I think it's something that connects us to each other.
Under the radar is all about discovery.
I can be guaranteed voices I haven't heard before.
But also the questions.
Under the radar is one step ahead.
I'm Callie Crossley. This week on Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump have officially clinched the required delegates for their Democratic and Republican presidential nominations. With the unofficial general campaign underway, both parties are eager to win the Latino vote. Will the Republican alignment with Latin American right-wing stars shore up support in the U.S.? Plus, long-held biases are emerging as across the state, temporary shelters are set up to house migrant families. And Big Papi threw the first pitch at the Red Sox recent exhibition game in the Dominican Republic, showcasing Dominican players' dominance in American baseball. It's our Latinx Roundtable. Later in the show, she's recognized as one of America's most respected singers, whose innovation and genius elevated jazz.
She had the power to transform and yet somehow synthesize the best of jazz and the best of pop and produce a hybrid.
Author Judith Tick argues that Ella Fitzgerald's musical influence went way beyond the jazz genre in her new book, Becoming Ella Fitzgerald, the jazz singer who transformed American song. It's our March selection for Bookmarked, the Under the Radar Book Club. But first, joining me now, Julio Ricardo Varela, MSNBC columnist and founder of Latino Rebels. Hi, Julio.
Hey, Callie.
And Marcela Garcia, an opinion columnist and associate editor at the Boston Globe. Thanks for joining me, Marcela.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's dive into some politics, of course. Most recently, President Biden upset a lot of people as he was making what many believe to be his strongest speech in a while, the State of the Union address. And in the middle of the address, he was heckled by Marjorie Taylor Greene. And here is the moment where he used the word illegal.
Not really. Lincoln Riley, an innocent young woman who was killed by an illegal.
All right. So MSNBC interviewed Biden after that moment when she heckled him about Lincoln Riley is the woman's name. And Biden described his mistake in using the word illegal.
You used the word illegal when talking about the man who allegedly killed Lincoln Riley.
An undocumented person. And I shouldn't have used illegal. It's undocumented. And look, when I spoke about the difference between Trump and me, one of the things I talked about on the border was that the way he talks about vermin, the way he talks about these people polluting the blood. I talked about what I'm not going to do.
All right. I'll have both of you respond to that. This obviously was off script, so he hadn't planned to respond to anybody, especially somebody heckling him, but he did, and this is the result.
I think it's important to just bring up one thing about the State of the Union, which was very powerful, is the sense that Biden got caught in this trap by Marjorie Taylor Greene. But I will say that what really was weird is that a couple of minutes later in the speech, you had President Biden saying, I'm not going to demonize immigrants. And you literally used a term that I know people say like, well, it's just a word. It's a very charged word that has led to a dehumanization of a population. And yes, he talked to Jonathan Capehart about it. And I think he's beyond it, but it still raises some issues as to what I've always said is that Joe Biden's he's a moderate on immigration. He's a tough talking Democrat of the 90s. And what we're seeing right now is just a repeat of when Bill Clinton ran against Bob Dole. So 30 years later, we're still dealing with this immigration issue, with labeling, with painting broad strokes about a community. And we all know that it's way more complex than that.
Marcela, Lincoln Riley was the name of the 22-year-old Georgia medical student who was allegedly killed by an undocumented immigrant from Venezuela. just for clarification, and that's what Marjorie Taylor Greene was heckling him about.
Yeah, I think he definitely, the episode definitely betrays the real sense or how Biden thinks about these issues. I think legitimately he doesn't really understand the power of language, but he understands that this is an issue that's important to the Democrats and to Latinos and to immigrant advocates. And I think the important thing for me, as disappointed as I was hearing him say this word that has used to demonize immigrants, to take their humanity away for so long, the important thing for me is that he apologized. He said, I should have known better, I should have said undocumented. And while he may legitimately feel that, oh, you know, who cares how I call them, I think he understood that it's important. And in that, the act of apologizing, I think that speaks a lot. I mean, when has ever Trump apologized? Obviously never, right? And not that Trump is a good comparison to make to anyone in this type of issues, but I think I'm willing to give Biden a little bit of credit for that, for apologizing a few days later, because I think he understood that he made a mistake.
Now let's move on to former President Donald Trump, who is looking to Latin American populist leaders to make a connection for him among conservative Latinos, U.S. Latinos, as a way of boosting or getting more of that Latino vote that's highly prized at this point. So before you guys respond to that, here is former President Trump introducing Argentina's new populist leader, Javier Milei, at the conservative CPAC annual conference last month.
He's gotten a lot. He's a great gentleman. You know, he's MAGA. He's MAGA. Make Argentina great again. It's true. Now, when he said, I am MAGA, then I realized he's one of the few can really do it well. Make Argentina great again. Javier Milei. Thank you very much, Javier.
All right. Julio, is this approach working?
You know, I have to say it's smart by Republicans to understand that there are some populist leaders in Latin America right now who are more center right, and Milei is a perfect example of someone who has almost like a Trump-like story to him, in the sense that he's an outsider. He wants to, you know, he wants to break down government. So there's a lot of populist messages that are coming out of Argentina that apply to Republican, you know, Trumpism in the United States. The other one is Nayib Bukele, who's the president of El Salvador. And I'll be honest with you, talking to, you know, my reporting with, for some reason, I know a lot of Salvadorans. He's incredibly popular with the Salvadoran American community in the United States. Now, will it move the needle? Maybe. Republicans are doing a very, very effective job in getting the Latino voters, the conservative Latino voters that need to vote for them. Simple as that. So it's just something to add to the overall message of the general election. And, you know, Trump and Republicans are smart to think about that some people are following what's happening in Latin America, even though there's not a lot of Argentines in the United States, numbers wise, but the overall sort of classic right-left Latin American dichotomy still, I think, is part of what at least some Latinos I know, like, they pay attention to.
So for you, Marcela, is this effective?
I mean, on some level it is, but I think what worries me about this is the lack of understanding it promotes about Latin American politics. And here's why. In the case of Javier Milei, he really isn't a conservative or a far-right politician as much as he's a libertarian. And I think the distinction matters because here in the media, because obviously there's a lot of confluence and there's a lot of overlap with certain political positions of the far right and even MAGA politics, there's some that aren't, you know, around personal liberties and, you know, government interference, blah, blah, blah. Like there is some confluence with progressives too. And so I think that I hope that we can start seeing politicians like Javier Milei and Bukele with a more sophisticated lens, I'm not holding on my breath that that's going to happen. But to me, the distinction is important because, you know, again, for the longest time, I feel like we've suffered. And you know, maybe to some extent, it's not surprising, or maybe it's too much to expect from a deeper understanding of Latin American politics. But it's always been the case that there's sort of a one-dimensional, two-dimensional understanding of what's going on down there, only to the detriment of, obviously, foreign relations, U.S. foreign relations. Of course, it does have implications for Latino voters here, because, again, the headline is, you know, far right, Javier Milei comes to CPAC, you know, to energize Republicans or, you know, Republican-leaning Latino voters. I think it might be effective. For the purpose of this conversation, I think it might be effective. In the case of Bukele, definitely, you know, his case is different. Like, it's very different. His whole thing is rule of law. And, you know, he has managed to reduce violence in Salvador, you know, by margins, like large margins, due to basically the suspending of civil liberties. And people love him for that, like Julio said, not just right here, but over there. And so, again, like, I just feel like, broadly speaking, I think we just need, I guess maybe more reporting, or just deeper reporting about what's happening there, in order to, you know, just have more dimensions brought into this argument. Because then what happens is, again, you get Latino here is sort of buying the narrative, oh, you know, MAGA, Javier Milei, Argentina, blah, 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 when in reality, it's a little more complicated.
Now, is it a smart move for the evangelicals who are Latino to voice apparently increasing support for former President Trump?
Yeah, well, yeah, totally. I mean, definitely, it's absolutely going to be one of the most things that I'm going to be watching out for in this election, the evangelical vote and the sort of the religious aspect of the Republican strategy and obviously Trump. There are, this is something that I'm hopeful for. I don't think this is actually going to pan into something, but there's a sector or a faction, if you will, of the evangelical Latino vote that is very anti-Trump, but it's also very dormant and silent. And so for the longest time, I have hoped and waited whether it's going to amount to a real sort of opposition. I don't think it will be, because you gotta remember that this people, I mean, the evangelical vote, they care about social issues like abortion and, you know, transgender issues, like, and they align perfectly with Republicans, and those are their issues. And so I worry that they're just completely going to forget about their opposition to Trump, or any sort of positions that, you know, where they may be in a position with him or against him, and then just vote along with Republicans. So again, I'm not, this is one another issue in which I'm not holding on my breath for, but I was hoping and wishing that it would amount to something, but I don't think it will. Because again, it for them, it's about abortion. It's about gay rights. It's about gay marriage too. I mean, you would think that it's already, you know, it's the law of the country, it's the law of the land, and yet it isn't. It really is. It really will be under threat if Trump gets elected. I'm talking about gay marriage in particular.
So let me just put this stat out here. There are about 10 million Latinos who identify as evangelical or Protestant, and that's approximately 3 in 10 evangelical Republicans, 28%, consider themselves evangelical. So just go ahead, Julio.
Yeah, two things about this. One, about that sector, and this is the American Values Atlas survey from 2023. 55% of Latino Protestants or like sympathize with Christian nationalism. So that's something that's a stark little data point, you know, and the only other group that sympathizes more with Christian nationalism are white evangelicals. So it's 66%. But I will counter. Here's the counter. Pew Research did a recent survey, maybe a couple of years ago, recent, like probably in the last 2 years, where the fastest growing sector of, you know, when they talk about faith in Latinos, 30%, I believe, are religiously non-affiliated. And you see Catholicism and kind of going down, which is very complex for anyone who grew up Catholic, like myself. But I do think that there is sort of a general trend in the Latino community, just like there is a general trend in overall mainstream U.S. society, that we've become less religious. So, you know, that's that. There's a contrast here that I think we're putting too much emphasis on Latino evangelicals and less emphasis on who are all the Latinos that are not religiously affiliated anymore, because that to me is the tension right now.
Yes. And as a lot of studies have shown, it's the nuns, not N-U-N-S, but the N-O-N-E-S, who are outpacing everybody who is affiliated in any sector, any religious sector. So there is that to consider as well. And it makes sense that Latinos would be a part of the nun group as well, N-O-N-E. Let me move on to like a group of stories that you've reported, Marcella, but are out here locally, about temporary shelters, how people feel about it, the temporary shelters put in place to help the onslaught of folks who have come to our city as migrants and have no place to live. At one point, we saw those horrible images of people lined up in Logan Airport stuck, and also in Boston hospitals lined up because they had no place to go. And here we are. Here we are. In the group of studies, stories that you've done, one of them was about the town of Harvard embracing two Afghan refugees. And I was interested in the comments on that article, which mostly said, hey, this is great, but there was only two of them. And so, yeah, that's why the community embraced them. And if there's more, and there are more every place else, potentially in the state, you know, that's why we have an issue. And it was a particular point of tension in Roxbury where, and in order to address the large numbers, the city set up a temporary shelter at the Melnia Cass. And here are two Roxbury residents, and this is a predominantly minority community. I spoke with CBS about their complaints about its being located in Roxbury.
It's okay to help, but I don't think that's the place to do it because kids and family go and enjoy.
As a community, voicing our opinion and our concerns for the youth center and the elderly programs going down there, and it just seemed like our voices weren't heard.
There's a lot of tension between people who'd like to help, but say, why us all the time? Those are the Roxbury residents where the temporary shelter is. There are other, and you've mentioned in your articles, why not go in other places like the suburbs, some of the wealthier suburbs. You've said it's complicated. Those people are not saying no. It's just, you know, hasn't happened, and there are other factors to consider. So I just wanted to ask you all in general to respond to the kinds of tensions around the high numbers of migrants coming and the temporary shelter issue, period.
First of all, about the town of Harvard story, yes, there was only two families, but the reason why I still wanted to write about is because they were still facing eviction, even when it was two families. When I started reporting on this, the town council, the select board members had voted to basically evict them. And I thought it was significant, right? Because in the heels of this whole story about Wellesley, Roxbury, et cetera, where do we put them? Here's a town, and mind you, these are refugees, right? Like this, the distinction is important because they come through a separate sort of pipeline of people coming or fleeing civil unrest and wars and whatnot. They have been vetted, etc. And these two families came from Afghanistan in the wake of our exit, of the U.S. exit in the country. So here are two families, just two families. Of course, it's a tiny town, 6,000 people, but they were still facing eviction. When I started reporting on it, the select board quickly changed its tune, and they were like, no, actually, no, we don't want to evict them. And so the story became like, oh, you know, they're embracing them because now that, you know, you're faced with some sort of pushback or some sort of media shaming, if you will, which I was not planning to do, obviously, was just going to expose, because they contacted me after I wrote the Wellesley story. This is how I learned about them. After I wrote the Wellesley story, they contacted me, the families, the local families working to support these Afghan refugees. They said, look what our town is trying to do. By the time the story ran, the Afghan refugee story ran again, the town had basically corrected its tune, and maybe it was legitimate. Maybe they tried to do something rushed, but their intent was never to evict them, right? So that's why I focused on that story. About the Wellesley versus Roxbury, or the why here, why not there, I think if you ask people in Roxbury now, which I have been doing and our newsroom has been doing, it's the controversy has really died down. I think people have sort of come to accept or to, I guess, agree that it's not that big of a deal that they're there. In fact, the one thing that was a concern to me about the plan of placing these families in Roxbury was that they were going to, quote unquote, display a few people who were using that center recreationally and even, you know, as an athletic center. They were moved to the Reggie Lewis Athletic Center. And we had a story a couple of weeks ago saying how it ended up being a blessing in disguise that they had been moved to the Reggie Lewis. And so I think that maybe that narrative hasn't been elevated in the media. And what remains is that sort of acrimony in the first place. But I think you would find a different sentiment now. About Wellesley, the Wellesley thing was also based on feedback that I got from readers after I wrote the whole Roxbury piece. And they were like, we want to host migrants. And they were pushing their town leaders, and they were, you know, they were trying to do the right thing. And I think after I wrote that story, the state, because this is the other part that people perhaps don't get, is that a lot goes into selecting a site for migrants. These are emergency shelter, what they call overflow shelters, right? And so they have to comply with a lot of things. They have to have a kitchen, they have to have showers, the facilities, right? And so after I wrote that column, I was told that the state sent a team to Wellesley, because the Wellesley leaders, local leaders, had said, yes, we want to host them. They sent a team to evaluate, to assess a property or a facility, and they realized that they couldn't use it because it didn't have a kitchen. And then the local people who had contacted me originally saying we can host some families, they said, doesn't matter, we can cater food, because that's why you need a kitchen, right? To be able to feed the families that you're going to host. And they were like, we'll pay for the meals, etc. It ended up being a kind of a logistical problem that I'm not sure was overcome. But at the end of the day, I think what I wanted to convey is that people do want to help, except that it's not as easy as saying, oh, let me bring, I mean, it's the whole plan too, with the state had put out a pilot program saying, if you're a family that has an extra bedroom in your house and want to host a family, let us know. On paper, it sounds great. And of course, it's a well-intentioned move, right? People want to help. But logistically speaking, operationally speaking, that sounds like a recipe for disaster. How are you going to evict families? How are you going to make sure that these people are not going to be entering a type of exploitative situation where you ended up like having migrants? You know, like it is much more complex than saying, let me open my home to families, right? And so a lot goes into it. I am willing to give the state a little bit of leeway, because it is a big challenge. But at the end of the day, again, altogether, like broadly speaking, I really wanted to convey that people want to help. Sometimes it's not that easy, but the sentiment is there. And just as there are people, and of course I have been writing about this, just as there are people who oppose having families sheltered in their communities.
Julio, you know, what, as Marcella said, some of the sentiment has changed. But, you know, as I read those comments and, you know, heard from a lot of people, there another thread that runs through is, How come it's so hard for the people who live here who don't have access to affordable housing, but these people come and they figure out a way to, you know, house them and feed them and blah, blah, blah. So there is a lot of that sentiment out there that as I read and hear.
We as a country have looked at this immigration issue through a very simplistic lens, and we're talking decades of it, that we're beginning, you know, the broad strokes of the, you can't be too simplistic in this. It's exactly what Marcella explained. I mean, it was beautifully explained in the sense of, it's not as easy as y'all think. So I really, really hope, and this is like my, that we begin as a country, like, and this is serious, like we begin to really look at this issue through that complexity. But given that we're in a general election, given that we already have two presidential nominees and it's March and this is going to go on till November, I don't think we're just going to see more of this. And I think in Massachusetts, I think Massachusetts is doing a very decent job in the end, given the challenges. And but I'm also very saddened by the fact that we have simplified this issue way too much. And I don't know if we'll ever improve on it.
Well, let me go to an immigration story that's joyous. I'm making a hard turn. And that's the Red Sox exhibition game down in the Dominican Republic. People may not know that 10% of American baseball players come from the Dominican Republic. And here in Boston, we have some pretty famous players, including Big Papi. And a couple of them, he included, were the leaders in the trip at the exhibition game. I call it a different kind of home game. So here are Red Sox legends David Ortiz and Pedro Martinez being welcomed to the field before they threw the first pitch in the DR.
Please welcome home, demos la bienvenida a casa, a Pedro Martinez. Y con él, and with him, David Ortiz.
I just love this story. Obviously, it showcases dominance of Dominican players and the long connection between the Red Sox and the players from the Dominican Republic. And it's just joyous, Julio.
Yeah, I mean, we have to acknowledge the fact, as much as the Red Sox are going through, I don't know what they're going through the last, I'm a huge Red Sox fan. So we have to acknowledge the fact that the Dominican Republic has a place in the culture of the Boston Red Sox in the last 20 years. And obviously with these two amazing ambassadors in David Ortiz, which I really love when people call him David and not David, and Pedro Martinez. And I think it was really smart of the Red Sox to dive in, because they're incredibly popular in the Dominican Republic because of Martinez and Big Papi and Manny Ramirez. And now you have Rafael Devers, and then you have Brian Bello, who just, they took the opportunity to give him a contract that weekend, and they signed him for a multi-year, multi-million dollar contract. Amazing story. Alex Spire's work in the Globe on how he was discovered, and now he could be the future of the Red Sox. He could, you know, there's a lot of people comparing him to Pedro Martinez. The jury's still out for me, but I thought it was great. I thought, you know, spring exhibition baseball, I don't watch, but I watch this because for me, that's Caribbean baseball. That's the baseball that I grew up with. And I just think it's joyous, and good on the Red Sox, good on the Tampa Rays, on the Tampa Bay Rays, and good on Major League Baseball for acknowledging like this is the future. They still have a lot of work to do because, you know, there is, you know, exploitation is part of baseball. And especially when you have young Dominican kids who are, you know, this is their dream. Major League Baseball needs to get better at that. But I thought it was great. And I was really, you know, it gave me a little bit of hope for the Red Sox this year.
A last word, Marcella.
No, I mean, I think it's overdue, frankly. I mean, I think it's great to see these stories covered. But I think it's overdue because, as Julio said, the role that Dominican Republic has played and Dominican players have played, not just in the Red Sox, but the MLB the league at large is huge, as evidenced by the fact that, I mean, I didn't know this until recently. I have to admit that I didn't know it, but every single Major League Baseball team has an academy in the Dominican Republic. And why do you think that is? Because of course they have to invest in the players, in the pipeline of players. It's a whole industry. Right. And I find that fascinating, the business aspect of it, right? But on the side of media, right? Like, I don't think we have fully understood here, or maybe people like Julio and me do, but not the public, the general public, the big role that the Dominican Republic plays in just the whole operations of MLB and the role of players, of Dominican players, and specifically, like Julio said, in the Red Sox. I hope it continues for sure. I'm excited to see what they're going to do during the season, because last year they had all sorts of nights devoted, not just on Hispanic Heritage Month, by the way. Well, of course, it's way after the season probably ends, but throughout the season, they had different nights. It was the Bad Bunny night in August, and there was also the Dominican night, Puerto Rican Heritage night, like all sorts of Latino themed nights. And this is obviously not just the Red Sox, but all the teams do this to one extent or another. But the Red Sox have definitely put a lot more thought into basically reaching out or just connecting the Latino players in the team to the local community here, the Latino community. And I suspect that is because there's a lot more people working for the Red Sox who are Latino, seriously.
Well, we got to leave it there. I'm glad for it to end on a high note. And I always love talking to both of you, so thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it was fun, as always.
Julio Ricardo Varela is an MSNBC columnist and founder of Latino Rebels. Marcela Garcia is an opinion columnist and associate editor at the Boston Globe. Coming up, from turning a nursery rhyme into a classic jazz tune to perfecting the improvisational singing known as scatting, Ella Fitzgerald's talent led her to become one of America's cultural icons. But how did Ella Fitzgerald become the legend she was? That's the question author Judith Tick asks and answers in her new biography of the famed vocalist, Becoming Ella Fitzgerald, the jazz singer who transformed American song. That's next. This is Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. I'm Callie Crossley.